Welcome to today's seminar. My name is Malin Mobjörk, and I am normally a researcher at the Department of Political Science at Stockholm University. But today, I'm here in my capacity of a member of EBA, the expert group of aid analysis. And EBA is a governmental committee under the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And EBA was established and was up and running from beginning of 2014. EBA has a task of independently analyzing and evaluating Swedish development cooperation. We do so, but mainly having independent authors writing report to, not for, the EBA group. And the authors are responsible for the analysis and the recommendations. By publishing a report, EBA works with ensuring the quality and not the content. To this date, we have published 10 reports and have 17 ongoing reports. And in several occasions, we arrange a seminar when a report is finalized. And so far, we have arranged 13 seminars, including themes as evaluation practices in Swedish aid, the global health, effectiveness of multilateral aid, and public finance management reform. Today's seminar, we will have 4 development dissertation briefs, which are possible to pick yourself up downstairs, but also they are on EBA's homepage. And the purpose with these briefs is to let researchers present core findings in their dissertations with focus on its policy relevance and have an audience which represents a lot of policy actors and, of course, researchers as well. Previously, we have launched 3 briefs, and today we have 4. And the presenters we will hear today is we will start with Abrak Sati, and then is followed by Angela Mobota-Sellström, Johan Broché, and Mikael Jonsson. And you can, of course, you say something more about yourself when you're coming up here. So first, each researcher will present their brief for maximum 15 minutes. And it's a short time, but we will find that in a good way. And if there are some clarifying questions, a short one, that of course we should take that immediately. But the questions and comments are for the following discussion. And during that discussion, we will have Annika Sundén from SIDA and Mimi Söderberg-Kovacs from Folke Bernadotte Academy. And then all we'll have a discussion about this with focus on general findings, on specific topics, but with encourage a focus on the relevance for Swedish development cooperation. To help with the time, we will have Jan Pettersson, also from EBA. But now, I will welcome the first presenters, Abrak Sati. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Abrak Sati, and I'm a researcher at the Department of Political Science at Umeå University. And just about 6 months ago, I finished my dissertation, which is called The Participation Myth, Outcomes of Participatory Constitution Building Processes on Democracy. And just to set the context for this brief talk, I should mention that prior to writing this dissertation, I used to work at International IDEA here in Stockholm. And it was actually while I was with them that the idea to this project took form. The thing is that while I was with IDEA, I quite soon realized that public participation in constitution-building processes in post-conflict states and in transitioning states was being issued as a policy recommendation. And it was being issued as a policy recommendation because of a number of perceived beneficial effects that it would bring about. And more than anything else, it was said and it was believed that public participation in constitution building should be endorsed because it will lead to higher levels of democracy after the finalization of the process. Now, it should be mentioned and duly noted that International IDEA is not the only organization that issues this policy recommendation. So does the United States Institute of Peace, so does Interpeace, so does the UNDPA, and a number of other organizations. And I mean, intuitively, at least for me, and I think for many practitioners working with these issues in the field, this notion and idea makes sense. I mean, public participation in constitution building should lead to increased levels of democracy. Surprisingly, however, no one had systematically tried to study this supposed relationship before. So that's what I do in my dissertation. And I think that one of the main reasons as to why no one had studied the effects of participatory constitution building processes on democracy before has to do with the fact that what we mean by participation hasn't been properly defined, neither in academic circles nor among practitioners. So rather, what we have here is a widely accepted and used label of participatory constitution building that has been designated to around 20 cases around the globe, which in turn indicates that public participation has been exercised in the exact same way in all of these cases, and that participants have been allowed the same amount of influence over the constitutional document in all of these cases, which is quite far from the truth. And now I will not be running through this in any detail, but just say that by looking at who the initiators of constitutional reform have been, by looking at how the forms of communication about the constitution building process has been constructed with the public at large, by looking at the degree of inclusion in terms of whether or not all segments of society have actually been allowed to participate or not, and by looking at the question of final authority as to who has final say as to whether or not the constitutional draft enters into force, I've been able to develop a typology of different types of participation, ranging from false to substantial. And of course, moving from false to substantial participation involves an increasing level of influence for participants. And the cases that are currently being referred to simply as being participatory are actually quite different from each other in terms of how much influence the people in these respective countries were allowed over the constitution. Now, the question to be answered is, of course, if more extensive forms of participation lead to higher levels of democracy or not. And just to bring a bit more depth to the analysis, I've also added 28 cases of what I call cases of non-participation. These are also post-conflict states or transitioning states that have also enacted new constitutions after conflict. But in these 28 cases, there has been no element of public participation in the drafting of the constitution whatsoever. The constitution in these countries have rather been drafted by political elites and lawyers exclusively. And if there's any truth to the statement of participation in constitution building leading to higher levels of democracy, then we should expect to see a clear difference among these two broader sets of groups as far as democracy levels after the constitution building process are concerned. So let's see how these expectations play out when we treat these 20 participatory cases as if they were just participatory, as if they were the same. By going about the analysis in this way, we actually have some encouraging results because 15 out of the 20 cases do manage to improve their democracy scores when comparing democracy levels prior to the constitution building process with scores afterwards. But at the same time, so do half of the cases of non-participation. And I think that it's at this point that it becomes crucial to look at some of the cases more individually in order to understand if it's really reasonable to assume that it's the participation of the people in constitution building that has led to increased levels of democracy, or if it's perhaps rather something else. And before I run through this, I should say that the democracy data is retrieved from Freedom House, and they use a reversed scale, which can be a bit confusing, but this implies that 7 on the scale is the most undemocratic a country can be, whereas 1 indicates the most democratic a country can be. So the higher the score, the more undemocratic; the lower the score, the more democratic. And what I'm going to show you on the next couple of slides are just a few illustrative examples, but they are still quite telling for a broader tendency that I've seen in my research. So let's start by having a look at Afghanistan, which has been categorized as a case of false participation, the participation type with the least amount of influence. In Afghanistan, as maybe many of you know, international actors had a very prominent role in the constitution building process there. And even though ordinary Afghans were allowed to get engaged in the process, the content of the document was decided by political elites behind closed doors. So people were not even in the least allowed to influence the content of the constitution. And in addition to this, the Taliban were excluded. They weren't allowed to participate. So this wasn't a very participatory constitution building process, even though many refer to it as such. But Afghanistan has still been able to increase its democracy score in the aftermath of the constitution building process, although not too much, but still slightly. Zimbabwe, in turn, has been categorized as a case of substantial participation, meaning the participation type with the most amount of influence for participants. In Zimbabwe, the constitution building process was initiated by domestic civil society organizations. There were constitutional education programs carried out throughout the country. People from all over Zimbabwe were able to participate in the process. And I would say that due to the constitutional education programs, people were actually quite well prepared to participate. But still, Zimbabwe, a case in which participation was exercised in a much more comprehensive manner than in Afghanistan, not only not manages to improve its democracy score after the completion of the process, but has seen its democracy score continuously decline. Then, of course, we have the South African case, a case which is categorized as consultative participation. And I won't go into the details of the South African case here, but suffice it to say that the South African constitution building process has become something resembling an international role model for successful constitution building. And for me, during the years of working with this project, it's become increasingly clear that the idea of public participation leading to increased levels of democracy is clearly nourished by this single case. And I mean, as we can see on the graph, democracy levels have improved quite substantially in South Africa when comparing levels before the process with afterwards. But at the same time, the same kind of dramatic improvement can be seen in Panama, which is a case of non-participation. Here there was no public influence at all, no public input whatsoever. The constitution was drafted by political elites exclusively. And the same applies to Hungary, also a case of non-participation, where democracy levels have improved considerably, even though there was no public influence at all. So, what does all of this mean? If public participation in constitution building processes doesn't lead to increased levels of democracy, maybe we should abandon it as a policy. I think many would perhaps say yes. I think that I, for one, would think that at this stage it would still be a bit too rash. I think that there are other aspects of participatory constitution building processes that should be researched. And furthermore, there are indications in my own dissertation that show that there might be circumstances under which public participation has a better chance of working in favor of democracy. And maybe we will discuss this later. And I think that my time is up. And thank you for your attention. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We are good in time. You really stick to it. Is this a short question just to clarify something or nothing? Good. Then we welcome Angela to the stage. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thanks for inviting me to submit my dissertation as a policy document. It was really fun to work on and to revise for this particular forum and venue, so I thank you for that experience. So, My dissertation is on armed group impunity for sexual violence. Impunity is, I mean, let me just say this, that a lot of people have difficulty with the term impunity. It's often mixed or confused with immunity, indemnity, but it is really a kind of much used cliche term in many respects. It means exemption from punishment or freedom from the injurious consequences of an action. So we often use impunity. We evoke impunity when we talk about the impunity with which governments, police, or arbitrarily arrest somebody and arrest dissidents. When we talk about abuse of using torture, we use that term impunity in that way, in that regard. So my dissertation has a number of different components to it, which I'll talk about. But I wanted to sort of begin exactly the way that I lay it out in the policy brief. The first is to just bring your attention to these different statements. The first set of statements are by former combatants of the rebel group CNDD-FDD. If you spend a year with no leave, and if you see your commander raping, you would also rape. Who will make a judgment against him? A chief was a chief. Sexual violence happened in CNDD-FDD. There were no strict laws. For FNL, we hear, if they could see you talking to girls, that simple suspicion equaled death. You would be killed, and they used a hoe. It was a less expensive instrument, and they used it to kill the guilty. FNL rules were written in a small notebook. We were taught the rules. So former combatants see wartime rape as banal. Some of them see it as very normal, as something that happens all the time. Others may describe it as a sign of weakness and indiscipline. Some are used to seeing their leaders and their fellow fighters commit these acts. They think it happens, is part of the theater of war. Others, less so. Some expect little or no consequences. Others expect retribution. This variation is under-theorized and unexplored. And that is really the set, how this dissertation is set up. It's to look at these differences, because I argue that they're not differences just about individual conceptions of right and wrong, but there are differences about the way an armed group might conceive of what is right and wrong, and most importantly, might develop attitudes and beliefs about the consequences for sexual violence. I began this dissertation also thinking about some of the policy dimensions. First of all, within the liberal peace-building kind of domain, UN Security Council Resolution 1325 and the gender resolutions in general, and measures for justice and accountability, think of the ICC, think of transitional justice mechanisms, all talk very much about impunity. Impunity is often cast as a determinant of sexual violence, particularly in post-war settings. So all the Security Council resolutions on gender mention impunity. Secondly, in peace processes, in negotiation processes, and in processes for justice, amnesties are viewed as a vehicle to impunity, and therefore to more violence. Amnesties and peace agreements are interpreted as leading to impunity because they kind of, I don't know, we hadn't really, I mean, at least until I worked on my dissertation, I wasn't really sure why. But I think the intuitive assumption was that if you pardoned people for violence committed during the conflict, that those same people would develop a sense of impunity. And for that reason, all peace agreements are now meant to exclude amnesty provisions for perpetrator groups of sexual violence. So I won't bore you with this stuff. This is about the actual sort of research design, the methods, the research question, the cases. But it's important to really keep in your mind that there are two parts to this study. The first part where I talk about methods is where I analyze the association between amnesties and post-settlement sexual violence. I wanted to see if there was any link with these amnesties in peace agreements and the levels of post-settlement sexual violence. And so that's part of it. And I did that by gathering evidence and events, post-settlement sexual violence events, in the first 3 years after the end of a negotiated settlement for different armed actors. And then in the larger sort of main part of the dissertation, I compared two rebel groups in Burundi. And I gathered data or evidence and views from ex-combatants of those rebel groups. So as a result, I ended up looking at 23 state and non-state actors in Africa's civil wars. These actors were from Burundi, DRC, Liberia, Mozambique, Sierra Leone, and South Africa. That is in the larger study about amnesties and post-settlement sexual violence. And as I said, I looked at two rebel groups. I asked which conditions lead to armed group impunity for sexual violence. And importantly, I defined this impunity not by defining it in the sense of were there rules, and therefore that meant that the lack of rules was impunity. I think that's a little bit tautological. I looked at the way armed groups believed whether or not there would be consequences for sexual violence. And then I had three primary factors that I was trying to investigate. These were the explanatory factors. And one way to think about it is to think about the relationship between weak enforcement and pardons. So that's just writ large, if you want to think about this as a theory for impunity in general, whether weak enforcement and pardons would lead to impunity. And I tried to measure that by looking at the quality of the prohibitions within rebel groups, the role of the authorities, whether they were negligent or not, and the presence or absence of amnesties. So what did I find? Well, in terms of post-settlement sexual violence, first of all, it's really interesting. I found that the majority of sexual violence events were quite complicated. It was very hard to distinguish between, you know, single incidence rapes, multiple incidence rapes, gang rape, mass rape. A lot of times these reports of sexual violence included various sort of dimensions. So I found 30 different combinations of post-settlement sexual violence. Secondly, I found, and we shouldn't be surprised about this, but we should be upset, that victims were grossly undercounted and unidentified. About 44% of the events that I looked at had an unknown number of victims. So for research purposes, that made my life very difficult and complicated, but it also speaks to the fact that we really don't know very much about these incidences. I found that the usual suspects for commission of settlement of sexual violence were governments, were the state, members of the police, the army. These were the ones who were most associated with reports of post-settlement sexual violence, much more so than rebel groups. I found that only a few actors in my universe of 137 events were responsible for really large-scale sexual violence events. I also found that it does get better, that in almost all the cases that there was a real reduction of sexual violence. And we can talk about the quality of the reports, the quality of the data, because I have my own kind of issues with the quality of the reporting on sexual violence. It makes some of these findings very, they need to be strengthened, I firmly believe. But I also found that amnesties are quite ubiquitous. I was really surprised that all the armed actors in my study had access to amnesty provisions in their settlement agreements. Most of them granted had partial amnesty, which was very limiting in terms of creating conditions for truth-seeking mechanisms, mentioning large human rights violations, excluding things like sexual violence, but yet they were still eligible for amnesty. And there were only four actors that had blanket amnesties, and those were the actors from Mozambique and Liberia. And then, to be sort of even more provocative, I found that those actors that had blanket amnesties actually didn't commit as much sexual violence afterwards as the other actors. So the fact of the matter was that blanket amnesties actually co-varied with lower levels of reported post-settlement sexual violence. And what happened to the two cases that I looked at, the CNDD, FDD, and the FNL? Now, these cases are very similar in many respects, but CNDD-FDD was a very diverse organization. It was made up of people who were formally trained and people who were informally trained. It used forced recruitment. It had support from outside of the country. It was larger, and it had higher rates of conflict-related sexual violence and also of sexual violence after it became a government. FNL, on the other hand, was a smaller group. They were believers. They practiced a very sort of evangelical Christianity. They had very limited international support. There were more women in proportionally in FNL than in CNDD-FDD. They had lower rates of sexual violence. And when we look at impunity, CNDD-FDD had the more stronger presence of impunity. And I mentioned in the policy brief that impunity is neither really fully present or absent, that there are gradations. But within CNDD-FDD, it was very clear that impunity was much more prominent. And the reason for that was that the punishment, the prohibition, was not clear. It was not constant. It was practiced in a very with a lot of variation. So individuals who I talked to and in the focus groups would say that sometimes you were killed if you raped. Sometimes if you raped a child or you attacked somebody's daughter, then something would happen to you. But generally, they did not know what the prohibition for sexual violence was. Whereas FNL was very clear. All the ex-combatants that I both in CNDD-FDD and in FNL, in different parts of Burundi, who participated at different times, all confirmed that in FNL you were punished for committing sexual violence. And the reason for that is that they had a very clear induction process. Their code of conduct was very constant. It only would change through an institutionalized process, and there was a peer policing mechanism. So individuals inside the organization policed each other at all levels, so horizontally as well as vertically. And I have a couple of conclusions, but the main conclusion is that when armed groups do not depend on voluntary support and recruits from the civilian population, they are likely to put in place unclear and inconstant prohibitions of sexual violence, which, if reinforced by authorities, generates armed group impunity for sexual violence. My policy recommendations are twofold. I mean, they're clustered in two different areas. The first is that there is no evidence that amnesties deter sexual violence. We just don't have evidence for that. Rather, there's much more evidence that we should be focusing on inclusive, transparent, equitable, and credible post-war justice. By and large, the main problem for the Burundians was the post-war situation and the levels of corruption within the Burundian society. The second sort of cluster of thinking about the policy dimensions is around actually armed group impunity and the way in which armed groups control sexual violence. We really haven't done enough to understand the incentives and the unique ways these groups can police themselves and control sexual violence. So that is where I will leave it because my time is up, and I'm happy for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.